in a way, in a very real way, everything exists because of potentiality. Everything exists in and as potentiality. If we really reflect carefully and honestly on our experience of living, we can see that living, or life, exists because of this possibility in potentiality. Whatever that particular experience is, it is because there is the possibility that it occurs. So that's a vast and all-inclusive perspective. Within the vast, all-inclusive perspective of what happens, there's the arena, you could say, that is your described personal experiences. As you, so to speak, become somewhat fluid or comfortable or capable of navigating that which seems personal to you. That which seems personal to you involves, to a certain extent, where you come from, your history as you understand it or perceive it. It could include what people have told you about what you went through, what happened when you don't remember something, say, from when you were very little. This is what you did, or this is how you were. They might even say, remember the time. And sometimes somebody will say that to you, and you'll actually remember that time. You didn't remember it before. But they're reminding you, assists you in remembering something about the life that you've been living. As you become relatively at ease, some people would call it integrated, with what you could describe as your personal arena, and part of the way we kind of know that we're relatively comfortable in this so-called personal arena is that this form, this body-mind form, feels relatively at ease as it's going through its moments now. To the degree that this isn't at ease, that this is strained, pressurized, contracted, not at ease, tense, that's a signal. And what is it a signal for? That's something we can find out if we look, if we investigate. If we don't avoid, if we don't deny what this actually seems like as it's looked at or felt, as it's examined, as it's an object of meditation. And we find out why it's uncomfortable. We find that out in a way that's direct, that's insightful. And in that insightful possibility, potentiality, this will sometimes spontaneously, right before our eyes, so to speak, it will resolve in some way. One can see it let go. Even big things that happened that were very, very difficult, so difficult that they might have been immediately repressed. When something very difficult happens to you, one of the things that the mind does is it protects against that and can defend, push that experience down, repress it, suppress it, deny it. Even those things that might have been suppressed or repressed or denied can arise and come through and resolve themselves. There's a story that some of you may know and some of you may not know. But about 3 days before Adolf Hitler took his life, He was in the bunker. The Russian troops were closing in on him. The end was near. He was going through a variety of experiences. One of the things that he was doing, among the many experiences, was he was basically frustrated and complaining that his army, the Germans, lacked courage. You might say he was blaming. In this, what you might have come to realize just through your own analysis, insane, neurotic, terrorized, pathological, psychotic world, something broke through. And 3 days before he took his life, he married Eva Braun. And this tenderness came forth. And a marriage ceremony was held. And shortly after that, he took his own life. Look at that, you might say, extreme of potentiality. You just know a little bit about what the history says about that man's life. And then this love, tenderness, blossoms. Why? Because it can. When we reflect on the legacy of awakening, the legacy of liberation, the legacy of what it means to comprehend or to know freedom, we can see that it occurs because it's possible, because of potentiality. So there was this deep, you might say, interpersonal experience there that Hitler was allowing between him and another person and the company of those who were present. We need to get clear also, not just about that, what we could call that personal arena where we come from, our history, what happened to us. But we also see that it's critical to become relatively fluid and at ease interpersonally with others, relationally with others. That some of what we can't even get in touch with when we're meditating or being with ourselves, reflectively, writing, observing ourselves, things about ourselves can come up in interpersonal relationships in a way that is very revealing. We need to get clear about the self, if you will, that's interpersonal. And this can take a good while, can it? For some people, to just be truly comfortable with one other person could take a little while. How about with everybody? Just how about with everybody in this room? An experiment that you can sometimes engage in to just see what happens is, if you're willing to do it, just look at different people, not invasively and not to stare. Just look at a person and then look at another person and watch how you change, and then another person and watch how you change and look at another person. Not just that they change, that's obvious. There's something different in everybody. But what happens over here? And you begin to see that everyone that you meet is a reflection to you of something about yourself. It's a vast potential without any limit. And we need to get somehow fluid and connected to this if it is going to be realized that this field of humanity intermingling is a tremendous classroom. It's a tremendous opportunity. Especially when you're encountering someone who seems radically and fundamentally different than you in look, in attitude, in tendency, in trait, in psychology, in emotionality, maybe in body. Those individuals that you encounter who you don't like. You don't like them for no reason at all that you can really actually put your finger on. And maybe it's immediate. They don't even have to talk. You don't have to smell them. You don't even have to get close. There's something that arises immediately that's aversive in your mind. We're not going to be able to see our mind clearly until we can look at how the mind operates in relation to the multiplicity of mirrors that are coming from the world of humanity around us. And so that's our social world, our interpersonal world. Intimately interfaced, if not, you might say, unified, not separate from our so-called personal arena. And some people seem to be very fortunate, it seems to you or to me. They seem to have very little or no interpersonal anxiety or apprehension or fear. They can talk in front of a group of people or sing in front of a group of people. And they can open up their heart and they can share themselves and they can talk about difficult things that happened to them and they can cry in public. They seem to even enjoy themselves. They don't seem inhibited. They don't seem preoccupied with holding the attention of others. They don't seem to be sucking the energy from a group or from a communication. They're authentic and yet somehow appropriate. You look at them and you think that person or that individual's balanced. I met a young man once at the end of a meditation retreat for reasons that I'd had no cognition of. You know, once we stopped meditating and we began to interact before everybody went their separate ways. And I can't remember where he was sitting during the retreat. All I know is that he shared the retreat with me and we'd all kind of finished. There's about 100 of us and I just looked at him and I just immediately wanted to talk to him. It's just like I liked him right away. I just felt like I want to talk to you. And so I went right up to him because I didn't feel particularly shy or bashful. Sometimes meditation helps. And I walked up to him and I said, hi. And he said, hi, and we started to talk. And we just talked about whatever, and it was very free-flowing and fun, and I can't remember the conversation content. And then I noticed when I stopped talking to him, there was another person there talking to him, and he didn't move. And then another person talking, and there's another person talking, and there's another person talking. Pretty soon there's six people, and they're all talking, and he was there as part of that. And I realized he's having an absolute ball, just hanging out, talking to people. Everybody seemed so comfortable with him. And I thought, is that because he's comfortable? I mean, he was fun, but he wasn't all that smart. He didn't seem all that deeply insightful. He smiled easily. So what's going on there? I'm observing this for a while, and then I felt a little, you know what it's like to feel envy? Maybe one or two people would walk up to me. Or six, maybe, if I really got lucky, and be interested in me. They seemed very interested in him, like I was. And this was during the time when cell phones were not that popular, and they were much bigger and heavier. And one went off, and it was in his pocket. Mm-hmm. And he answered the cell phone, okay, because I had stood back at this point. I decided to be meditatively observant of the situation and not be so involved. So he picks the cell phone out of his pocket, and somebody called him, and they were inviting him to come to Austria, if he wanted to come and stay with him in Austria. And he was like, let me finish up my retreat here, and I'll call you back. I'll let you know, okay? I'm not sure what I'm doing next. He literally said that. I'm not sure what I'm doing next. At that point, I waited for, you know, the others, and I went, got back into this, because I was like, okay, I'm going to see what I can learn from this, I guess, I'm thinking. I'm sort of like the bee to the honey. Let me get close to this situation and see what, you know, I can learn. So I decided to ask a couple of personal questions. I said, where are you from? He said, I'm from South Africa. He's Caucasian. I said, tell me about that. What's it like to be raised in South Africa? He started to tell me, and I realized, actually, he's smarter than I thought he was. He's very articulate about his experience of being a white person in South Africa and coming up during the time of apartheid and the separation, and how awful he felt as privileged and white and in control and resourced. And not too far away, there were those who had much, much less. And he said, give me snippets of that experience. And as we were talking, his cell phone went off again. He pulled it out again, and he answered it again. And somebody else was inviting him to another place. I can't remember where it was, Minnesota or something. It was in America. And he said the same thing. He said a person who invited him to Zurich, he said, let me call you back, because I haven't finished this retreat yet, and we're just talking, having some conversation. I'm going to have a meal. I don't know what I'm doing next. Then I realized for myself what it was that I was liking about him. What I was liking about him is that it seemed to me he felt freer than I felt. He acted freer than I acted, than I knew how to act. He thought freer than I felt I knew how to think. His face looked freer than my face felt to me. And I realized that I wanted what he had. I was surprised and pleased at how many people over the last couple of weeks commented to me and asked me, did you see the PBS special on the life of the Buddha? And these were some people that I thought, no, these people wouldn't watch such a show, wouldn't be particularly interested in meditation or the Buddha. And it led into some short but interesting conversations to talk about that. I want you to imagine something now with me. Imagine that you meet a Buddha. That's a fully realized being. Let's go with human being. Fully realized in what? Fully realized in the sense of true potential. First of all, how would you know? How would you know? How would you know that you are looking at or listening to a Buddha? You might say, I might say, because I would sense it, I would feel it. Would I feel it or sense it because I would feel different than that being? I would feel perhaps attracted to that being? I would want what that being has? You know, there's some beings, as the legend tells us, that during the time of the Buddha, they didn't want what the Buddha exhibited. They might not have even liked it. They tried to kill him. They hated him. They felt threatened by him. Why? Because of the potential inside their mind to do that. Do you know what you really want? Is that clear to you? And if it is it also clear that wanting it, or let me put it this way, wanting it alone won't bring it? I wanted what that young fellow, he was a little younger than me, I wanted what he seemed to have. Doesn't make it happen. From the age of 29 to the age of 35, as the legend tells us, non-stop, the Buddha was investigating, to the point where he went beyond the teachings of anyone around him who could guide him, and he was completely and utterly on his own. And what does the tale tell us? It's an epic tale, yes. The legend, the story. It's not a myth. It's different. It's a legend. What does it tell us? He's sitting in the last meditation on the full moon night in May under the Bodhi tree, and Mara, which is the Buddhist personification for evil, attacks. What is that metaphorically representing? That the full potentiality of hindrance, of difficulty, of suffering, of craving, delusion, aversion, was released. And in that same sort of realm of potentiality, as the legend tells us, he reached a and he touched the earth, and thus he indicated, the earth bears witness to my right to sit here and not be swayed. Do you notice how vulnerable at times the mind is to being swayed, pulled this way and that way, distracted? How much potential at times is there? How much vulnerability is there? How do we have the vulnerability and openness to not only inhabit the fullness of this personal, interpersonal experience of living here, but at the same time realize the true potential of our being here? The Buddha showed anyone who is attracted to that life and teaching that it's possible, in potential, for everyone to realize what he himself realized. What's fascinating is, just like wanting what that fellow seemed to have that seemed attractive to me, wanting doesn't make it happen. But without the attraction, it doesn't happen either, does it? So once the attraction is activated, once the interest is there, to actually work with your experience, in most cases, it's like getting on a train and you don't get off. You bought your ticket, you're on. It's very, very difficult for any extended period of time. Once you begin to see the possibility of living in a way that's free from ignorance, from craving, aversion, and delusion. To go back and become heedless and uncaring, and once again suffering the consequences of that. So it feels at times as if you're going forward towards something, as if your potentiality is forward in time and space, and you're going to move to it. But in truth, all that's happening actually in the shedding, and it is a shedding, a transformation, a release from inhibition, and I don't just mean that at a sort of a personal arena level, in a total level, a complete level, the liberation from inhibition doesn't happen just because you want to be uninhibited. It happens because of this potentiality for freedom to manifest through each and every experience that's happening. Freedom isn't an experience that's other than the experiences that are happening. Freedom is the experience of the freedom to experience. Full on. And we can see in our human experience that this sometimes is taken to extremes. We see amongst even those that are close to us the denial of experience, the avoidance of things. Sometimes those things are wholesome, sometimes those things are unwholesome. We also see the indulgences, the extremes of those indulgences. The irony that now, as we sit here in Haiti, and for reasons that you can comprehend very quickly, the government is wanting the extensive surplus of food that is being donated, and it's a ton of food that's still being given. They're denying, wanting to deny that access, even though people are starving still. Why? Because we can't get our economy going again. Those who grow food here cannot sell their foods if these supplies keep coming in from other countries. And so, stop. And down the middle of that dance, right, there are people who are not getting food right now. There it is, another manifestation of potential. It includes the tragic. What if the Buddha decided after his meditation to never teach? Just take that possibility. What if Jesus never taught? Just take that possibility. Just take it out of the equation of life as we know it. Just take out of the equation of life as we know it the manifestation of any scriptural text, whether it's supposedly interpreted by human beings or directly divinely inspired. That's supposed to be the definition of a scriptural text. It's a divinely inspired text. It comes from something other than human. And then we're left to figure out, what does that mean? Is there such a thing? How does that happen? I mean, even this challenging piece that the Buddha was supposedly born out of his mother's side, and when I mentioned that to somebody the other day, they went, oh, you mean a C-section? I said, well, no, I think C-sections come out the front right here. I don't think we cut over here in the oblique on the side. The person was like, huh, never heard of that. Is that a myth? Was that a metaphor? Jesus having no earthly father? Is that a metaphor? A literal thing? Will we ever know? Does it matter? The good news, and there's a lot of good news, if we are open to seeing it, is that the inborn, innate, inherent skill or capacity to directly experience our experience without filtration, or with minimal filtration, that means interference, and to see for ourselves what is true, to know for ourselves what is true. This is really the legacy, from beginning to the end, if you look at the Buddha's life, this is the legacy that he left. Come and see for yourself. Look and see, because that's exactly what he did. He could have taken someone else's experience and lived by that. Could have read books and taught from that. In potentiality, it could have gone all kinds of different ways, because if you can imagine it, if you can imagine a different thing, there's a potentiality. All potentialities are interesting if they arise, even as imagination. Carl Jung said it very clearly, I feel. He said, you do not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but rather by making the darkness conscious. Very poignant, compelling, evocative suggestion or teaching. Making the dark, what is the darkness? Everything you don't know, that's shrouded, that's covered, that's hazed, or as someone today described it, I have an area of my experience that feels clear to me, and then I have this area, and they put their hands right here, and they said, over here it's fuzzy. It's over here, it's fuzzy. And as we began to explore the fuzzy, it turned out it was kind of gray fuzzy. And then it was sort of dark, and it was sort of slower moving, more contracted. And what was looking at that fuzzy was something of the clear, was looking at the fuzzy. And there was a lot to learn about the fuzzy. And it was playful. And it was painful. And it was fuzzy. Making the darkness conscious. He's talking to both the personal, the interpersonal, and he's talking to the areas of experience that are transcendent of the personal and the interpersonal. For some people that's described as spiritual, but I'd rather just use the word transpersonal, which is beyond the personal and the interpersonal. And by the way, that's not some abstract esoteric thing. The transpersonal is immediate. It's right here. It's in this room as much as the personal and the interpersonal. Making the darkness conscious. Because there's tremendous potentiality in the darkness. There's tremendous potentiality in what is incomplete within you. What in Gestalt therapy is called unfinished business. If you think about someone in your life that you've known, whether they're living or they've passed, and in some way your heart, mind, body contracts, you have some degree of unfinished business there. Maybe you've been hurt. Maybe you've been misunderstood. Maybe you hurt. Maybe you misunderstood. This template, or this, you might say, gauge, body-mind process, you can learn to listen to it in a way where you transcend deception. You notice how we live in a world where sometimes there's layers upon layers upon layers of deception? Is the SCC going to actually get to some truth with Goldman Sachs? Are they going to be able to penetrate in there and work the case? Was wrong done? Were people ripped off? At the same time, those layers of deception can be there such that sometimes people agree to live in it. They agree and they become complicit and live in deception. Meanwhile, behind that or beneath that, this heart, body, mind, gut sometimes is where it is for people. It knows the truth. It's like a truth meter. It's able to register and know what is true. It's an instrument. And it is the vehicle for awakening. I don't know why. I'll close on this note. I don't know why, for sure. I don't hardly know anything for why, for sure. Maybe it's because I'll be 54 years old chronologically on my next birthday, that the mind at times reflects about how much time is left. It sees the growing sun not too far from leaving the home, it seems. And out of that comes a hand that sort of grabs on. And what will it be like when his room is empty? What you begin to see, and this doesn't happen just at midlife, wherever that occurs, is that this is temporal. It's transitory. It's actually ephemeral. This set of waking states is actually a bardo. Bardo is a Tibetan term for transitional zone. It's an in-between. When I first heard about the bardos, I thought, oh, the bardos exist as these spaces after you die. I had no idea whether it's true or not, but I thought that's what they're talking about. And it went a little deeper, and it became clear that dream states are bardo states. The deep sleep state is a bardo. And it came full circle. The waking state are bardos. What's happening here right now, any moment, every moment, is in between. In between what? Very simple to see, very easy to see. What's happening right now is in between what happened before, what happens after. Piece of cake, no problem. Look a little closer. If it's clear that all this is transitory, all this is ephemeral, nothing lasts, then in a more complete and full and deeper and ultimate sense, what does it mean that this that's happening, the whole set of waking states, from the first moment of conscious awareness, whenever that was, up till maybe the last breath, if that's how it goes, it's all in between. The name of the game is to find out in between what? That is a koan. The waking states are in between what? Notice that it's impossible to answer that with your intellect in any satisfactory way. If you can let yourself feel into the mystery of no answer that you can conceptualize, then the koan is working. So, anything that you'd like to explore tonight?